Welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, a new poll shows that Florida voters are split right down the middle when it comes to the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. This week, our state's representatives in Congress reflected that division. Republicans in the House, led by Panhandle Congressman Matt Gaetz, stormed a secure facility where classified depositions are happening related to the probe looking at Trump's dealings in Ukraine. They demanded open public hearings. Here's how Gaetz described it.
We were the 300 standing in the breach to try to stop the radical left from storming over our democracy. And I think we made the point that President Trump deserves due process.
Then Democratic Representative Val Demings of Orlando apparently shouted down the group who had stormed into the SCIF. That stands for Sensitive Compartmentalized Information Facility. Here's what Demings had to say on MSNBC.
It's impossible to defend that which is indefensible, but the Republicans sure tried to yesterday, to the extent of storming the SCIF with their cell phones, a major violation of our security.
Meantime, new polling also shows that Governor Ron DeSantis enjoys very high approval ratings here in the state. But new questions are emerging about the governor's ties to some of the Florida players in the Ukrainian scandal. Lots to get into here, so we're going to start the hour here on the Florida Roundup with a closer look as we welcome Steve Contorno, political editor with the Tampa Bay Times. Hey, Steve. Hopefully we'll have Steve in a moment. Also with us, Mike Binder. He directs the Public Opinion Research Lab at the University of North Florida. Mike, good to have you on the show.
Good to be here, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And what are your questions about the impeachment scandal and how it relates here to Florida? Give us a call here on the Florida Roundup from wherever you are here in the state. The number, 305-995-1800. That's 305-995-1800. We're already getting your tweets. Send them to at Florida Roundup. Steve Contorno with the Tampa Bay Times, help us connect the dots here on this fast-moving scandal. Now, this week we saw Matt Gaetz lead the Republicans into the SCIF. Val Demings, the Democrat from Florida, got into a shouting match with them. All of this tied into the probe into whether the president withheld aid to Ukraine unless they agreed to publicly investigate Joe Biden and his son. Now, at the same time, you're getting some new information on two Florida men who donated money to Governor DeSantis, Igor Fruman and Lev Parnas. They are the two Rudy Giuliani associates indicted in the midst of all this last week. What is your reporting uncovering here?
Yeah, when they first were indicted, there was a mad rush to see sort of who else they had given money to other than those listed in the indictment. There were contributions made in Nevada and Texas. And it turns out that Governor Ron DeSantis received $50,000 from the two men through a limited liability corporation. And DeSantis sort of immediately returned the money and said, his spokesperson said, he has no relationship with these people. You know, they may have attended some large Republican Party events together, but that was about it. Time passes, and lo and behold, not only did they hold fundraisers for Ron DeSantis, but they were at his inauguration. They were actually hugging with him after he announced his victory. And there's, just more and more has come out since. Politico had a story last week that showed Lev Parnas was traveling across the state of Florida with the governor as he hit his home stretch of the campaign.
Right. It raised some questions about whether Parnas and his associate were actually flying with the governor in his plane. Could he have been flying with Rudy Giuliani, though? Do we know?
We don't know the travel arrangements. I mean, it sounds like there was maybe a caravan of planes crisscrossing the state during that sort of like mad rush toward the end. And certainly there's a photo of Lev Parnas on a flight with Rudy Giuliani, and then appearing at two DeSantis events right before the election. So it seems that they were traveling together, whether they were on the same plane or whether they were just, heading in the same direction isn't clear, although his office has adamantly said that that they were not on a plane together.
All right, and it's 305-995-1800. Give us a call here on the Florida Roundup. Mike Bender, who heads up UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab in Jacksonville. Let's turn to you now. You've got new polling on both impeaching the president, how Floridians feel about that, and also the governor's approval ratings. Let's start with the impeachment numbers. No surprise, the state is split. What does the data show?
Yeah, the state's very divided. We asked two questions about impeachment. One was about formally starting the impeachment process. In that case, it's 49 to 47 supporting starting the inquiry. And then we asked a follow-up about being impeached and then removed from office, kind of that second and third step of the process. And that is 46 approve, 48 oppose, both within the margin of error. And that really just highlights Florida as this battleground state where folks are in their camps, and much like we've seen with a lot of these elections in the past, it's right down the middle.
Right down the middle, just like we come to expect here in Florida. Now, you also polled the state's voters and found most approve of Governor DeSantis. He's enjoying bipartisan support right now. As we continue to track this Ukrainian matter, any chance that could change? Did you poll on that?
We didn't poll on that, mostly because we, you know, we were in the field the 14th to the 20th, and while things were starting to come up about this, the pictures hadn't come out yet, and really we didn't know a lot. We still don't know a lot, necessarily. But his approval rating in our survey was 72%, which is enormously high for a governor in a state that is often so politically divided. Even Democrats, 56%, approve of the job that he's doing. Independents are at 77, and Republicans obviously are very high at 91. But if this continues, and if we learn more, and if there's a closer connection, I certainly would envision that to chip away at some of his job approval numbers.
Steve Contorno, you reported back in September that the governor's political committee had developed a sort of shopping list for paid meeting opportunities with the governor and his wife. This ties back to campaign money going to the governor. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's all sort of coming a little bit full circle here, because $50,000 is from these two Ukrainian, Soviet-born men is interesting given the context of what we reported then, which was essentially within days of Governor DeSantis taking office, his political team was putting together a plan for how to keep him in front of the most powerful and influential donors in Florida and across the country, and how to sort of build a money-making machine that would fuel his future political ambitions, which some have speculated go beyond Florida to the White House. So what we found was that they actually put together sort of a menu of opportunities to spend time with the governor, and included $25,000 to golf with him, $100,000 if you wanted to play with him one-on-one, $125,000 for a 15-minute meeting with him, and $250,000 for a dinner event. And, you know, his office said that, or he said that he never saw these memos that we obtained, and that, you know, they don't affect how he does his day-to-day job. But one of the memos explicitly says that they reached out, that he approved, him and his wife, First Lady Casey DeSantis, approved the fundraising plan that was laid out as they were trying to figure out how to implement it.
All right, let's go to your calls now. As this Friday on the Florida Roundup, we talk about the impeachment inquiry into the president and its ties to Florida. 305-995-1800, give us a call. Nikki is in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Nikki, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to make a comment that I just don't get, and I'm sorry it's not directly about the impeachment, but I just don't get why the only people that are really happy about pulling the troops out of Syria so quickly is Putin and the Turks. I mean, it's just like insane. I don't disagree that it would be great to have our troops home, but to do it so suddenly, and you see the smiles on these leaders' faces as they talk about what their actions are. I don't get it, and I just also don't get how can a leader reject a subpoena? How does that happen? What are we remaking the laws? That's all.
All right, Nikki. Yeah, thanks for that. Let's toss this back to UNF's Mike Bender now. Nikki brought up a separate matter that's become controversial for the White House, the president's moves in the Middle East and in Syria, but that is tangentially tied to the impeachment inquiry. In terms of whether there are ties, whether there was a quid pro quo in Ukraine, the officials that have worked in Ukraine, Mike, have expressed concern that these moves could destabilize the region. And at the same time, what about her comment that in ignoring congressional subpoenas, that's not flying with at least some voters here in Florida?
Well, obviously, that's two separate sections. I think the first one, the issue about taking the troops out of Syria, it may not seem like it's important for impeachment, but in a lot of ways, it could be very important politically. And I say that because, first off, Trump was very clear when he was running his campaign that he wanted to pull back troops from across the country and be less involved internationally with our military. This is, and you could certainly say, an example of that. The problem is many within his own party are vehemently opposed to the process in which it was done, how it was done, and the implications for our Kurdish allies in the region. Now, that matters for impeachment because, let's be clear, there are absolutely some legal loopholes and some legalities that need to be worked through for impeachment, but this is wholly a political process. It is housed in the House of Representatives, a political body. It will be voted on and tried in the Senate, which is another political body. And you're going to need to get votes from two-thirds of the Senate, which requires, you know, almost 20 Republican votes. And if Republicans turn on Trump, you can look at these types of behaviors as a potential reason why, aside from any quid pro quo with Ukraine and anything else. This type of move in Syria is something that some senators could look at to say, hey, you know what? This person shouldn't belong in office.
Lots of tweets.
Now, as for this,
go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
As for the subpoenas, this is nothing necessarily new. A lot of presidents and have called executive privilege and have ignored subpoenas over the years, and it's up to the courts to ultimately determine which ones need to be upheld and not.
Lots of tweets and calls. Meanwhile, let's go to D.C. and Fort Lauderdale. D.C., how are you this Friday?
Good. Although I'm disappointed with the Democrats in their defense regarding this impeachment process. The House of Representatives must act as a grand jury because there is no special prosecutor, no special counsel as there was in Watergate and in the Clinton impeachment process. A special prosecutor, of course, conducting investigation behind closed doors, as Mueller did, would finish the investigation, hand the results over to the House to engage in the impeachment process. But we don't have a special counsel in the Trump case. We're not going to because of Barr. He would never allow that. Mm-hmm. So the House must act as a grand jury. And that must happen behind closed doors. You can't have people storming a grand jury saying, oh, this has got to be transparent, and you have to have it open to the public so everybody can see it. That's just nonsense. Any lawyer knows that, and all these Republican legislators know that. So they're engaging in a propaganda deceit on the public. To claim that, Democrats aren't acting properly in this case, and it's not true.
All right, D.C., you know, thank you for that. Steve Contorno with us from the Tampa Bay Times. Let's point out that both Senator Marco Rubio and Senator Rick Scott from here in Florida criticized the actions of Congressman Gates and his colleagues in the House, although they also made a point of criticizing the probe itself. But what does that say about the divide among our political leadership here in Florida over this whole matter?
Yeah, there's certainly no love lost between Rick Scott and Matt Gaetz. They do not like each other, to put it mildly. Mm. And they got in a bit of a political tiff earlier this year, when the governor Senator Rick Scott was leaving the governor's mansion as Governor DeSantis was taking over. Matt Gaetz sort of accused them of a bunch of shenanigans on the way out the door, and has created sort of this rift in the Republican Party going forward. And you know, Senator Marco Rubio also has his own aspirations politically as well. So you have all these sort of like divided camps in Florida, different Republicans all trying to ingratiate themselves with the president, but also very mindful of sort of where Florida is politically and where the sentiment is on impeachment, on President Trump's foreign policy initiatives. It's been interesting to watch them all sort of walk this tightrope.
Here's a tweet from Josh listening to the Florida Roundup. He says, if using the office of the president to extort an ally in order to punish a political opponent doesn't constitute high crimes and misdemeanors, I'm not sure what does. Another tweet for you, this one having to do with the governor and Steve's reporting. It looks as though DeSantis is rampant with corruption. Governor DeSantis returned the campaign money from the folks that are tied to this probe. We need to make clear on that. Let's take one more call on this. It's Christine in Henderson, Florida. Hi, Christine. Go ahead. Hey, Christine, are you with us?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Christine.
I find the behavior of Representative Gaetz repugnant. I'm a former member of the GOP. I went to a non-political affiliation back in 2007. I'm also a postgraduate working on my doctorate in political science. And this whole process seems to be more of a dog and pony show than actually getting down to what really matters, and that is that this president is wholly unfit for office.
Thanks for your call, Christine. Mike Binder, you poll folks of all political persuasions in Florida in a tight state where both parties are seeking any movable voters. How will this all play out, do you think, in 2020? You know, we've got a lot of no party affiliated voters in Florida, let's point out.
We do, and they're actually very interesting because, and while the caller may be very well an exception to this, by and large, NPA voters in Florida aren't nearly as engaged. They often don't turn out as much as they are registered in the state. However, when we asked them about impeachment and removal, it was 46% support, 42% opposed. But what was fascinating to me was 37% strongly support and 32% strongly opposed. Oftentimes, the NPAs are more likely to be in the somewhat categories, but they had very strong opinions on this. And I think that speaks to how deep this issue is across the country and how independents are being touched by it. And I might expect them to turn out in a little bit bigger numbers than maybe we've seen in the past.
Could drive some turnout. So could marijuana. You also polled on the ballot initiatives to legalize it in Florida for recreational use. Just want to quickly make mention, you found that is overwhelmingly popular in Florida.
Yeah, 64% approve of recreational marijuana. But what's interesting to me is it's not just Democrats and independents. Republicans are even at plus 54% approval.
Yeah, that's new.
54% yeah. Approval, right? Yeah. Like, I think that's something to think about and talk about here in this state.
Thank you. Mike Binder runs UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab. A quick break, and in a moment, voting rights in Florida and election security issues. They're cropping up once again. Can you believe it? That's next here on the Florida Roundup. We'll be right back. You're listening to Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross. Well, this week, Florida officials said the state's election website for gathering petitions is basically broken. Florida Secretary of State Laurel Lee says the problem is due to a tight timeline the state's working with to build a new online system for petition signatures. Now, all of this happened after lawmakers voted for big changes to the way those signatures are collected in Florida. We're going to continue the discussion now with Steve Contorno, political editor with the Tampa Bay Times, and new with us now, Ian Sancho. He's the former supervisor of elections in Leon County, Florida. That's Tallahassee. He's with us from WFSU. And we're continuing with your calls here to the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. Tweets to at Florida Roundup. Steve, earlier this week, you reported we're at a crisis point on this when the state acknowledged this website for gathering petitions just isn't working. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, that was the words of one of the leaders of an organization that's trying to register people to collect petitions to get an initiative on the ballot. The problem is the website to register these people is so problematic and has been down repeatedly over the past month that people can't get these registrants, these petition gatherers signed up. And it's cost these organizations that are on a very tight timeline to get, you know, 750,000 people to sign a petition. It's made them cost them a lot of money and a lot of time to try to get this done. And they've, you know, the state has now created a workaround to try to help those people out who are still trying to register their petition gatherers. But from what I've heard from multiple people who are trying to get petitions and get initiatives on the ballot mm-hmm. for constitutional amendments, it's just been one nightmare after another. And it all goes back to a law that lawmakers passed and Governor Ron DeSantis signed earlier this year that tried to make it a lot more difficult for these groups to get constitutional amendments on the ballot.
Right, making it tougher just to get the signatures they need. They want more signatures. I know that's one change. Ian Sancho, this problem, as Steve said, affects activists on a range of issues, whether they're trying to get a measure to increase the state's minimum wage on the ballot, or attempts to get legal marijuana on the ballot, or that petition push to ban assault weapons. This will make it much harder for all of those issues to get before the voters, correct?
Well, yes, and sadly, this is not the first time that the petition gathering portion of the statewide voter registration database has failed. In fact, it has failed more than once. It failed while I was supervisor of elections, and I retired in 2016. So in 2012, 2014, the system didn't work well. And quite frankly, it probably isn't designed to work well because petition gathering is not favored by the Republicans, which control the Florida legislature. And as Steve has pointed out, they've made the laws more difficult, and they've done it consistently over time because they don't want citizen initiatives to be added to the Florida Constitution because, quite frankly, it contravenes their own policy positions that they promote.
Now, that gets to another citizen initiative that did pass last year, Ian. Overwhelmingly, voters approved Amendment 4, giving people who were convicted of a felony the right to vote. The legislature didn't like that amendment passing, apparently, because they passed another law saying that these former felons have to pay fines and fees before they can cast a ballot. There's been a recent ruling on that as well as relates to voting. Tell us about that.
Yes, U.S. District Court Judge Robert Hinkle issued a 55-page ruling a couple of weeks ago and pointed out that the law that the Florida legislature passed this past spring in Senate Bill 7066, quite frankly, was an administrative nightmare, impossible to administer. And I'd like to just read one of his sentences from this opinion. When an eligible citizen misses an opportunity to vote, the opportunity is gone forever. The vote cannot be later cast. So when a state wrongly prevents an eligible citizen from voting, the harm to that citizen is irreparable. And I think that sums up what the judge is telling the legislature. There's going to be a trial in April on this case, and he wants the legislature to change that law, or the legislature is forewarned he's going to strike the law down that the legislature passed in this arena.
All right, that's where it stands right now. And if you're just tuning into the Florida Roundup, where do you stand on all of these hot button issues activists are trying to get on the ballot next year, like legalizing marijuana, banning assault weapons, raising the minimum wage? Maybe you've signed one of those petitions in support of one of these issues. It turns out the website the state has put together to count those petition signatures isn't even working right now. It's going to make it a lot harder for these measures to get on the ballot next year, and we're discussing it right here on the Florida Roundup. The number to call us up is 305-995-1800. Steve Contorno of the Tampa Bay Times. The League of Women Voters has condemned the state over this. There's been a letter from the Citizens for Energy Choice. They've demanded answers. So the state's taking some heat on this, aren't they?
Absolutely. And to get back to the Amendment 4 issue, I think the legislature is now sort of in a position where they have to act regardless of what happens at the legal level. I mean, Representative Jamie Grant, who was the author of the Amendment 4 bill, said that the ruling that Mr. Sancho just quoted was a spanking, and that they would have to clearly make some changes to abide by it. And you know, he was also one of the authors of the bill that that made it more difficult to collect petitions, and that now is having administrative problems as well. Mm. You know, they only had a month to sort of put together the website and the bureaucracy and everything to abide by the new rules, which essentially said, you know, you have to pay your petitioners a wage, or, you know, you can no longer pay them per signature collected. It had to be a wage or some sort of hourly rate, which isn't the norm in most states. And put all the, you know, and Governor DeSantis said essentially that the goal of what they put out there was to make it harder to get constitutional amendments on the ballot, because their belief is that it shouldn't be so easy to make changes to what is the, you know, most important governing document in the state, sort of overlooking the fact that most of these issues got on the ballot this last go around because the Constitutional Review Commission put them there. That was especially the most confusing ones, was the work of a body that mostly was made up of people that they put there.
It's 305-995-1800. Give us a call here on the Florida Roundup. Randy's calling from St. Petersburg. Hey, Randy. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Great topic.
Thanks.
I just want to say that the Republican Party, this is a ploy with the voting rights, the felon voting rights, to keep the citizen of Florida from having a voice. What they're doing is illegal. The law was passed overwhelmingly. People voted for it, and now the Republican Party wants to come back and say, well, now they need to pay all their fines, which is sometimes millions of dollars. This is ridiculous. The Republican Party wants to stay in power. They don't want the citizens to have a vote. So that's why they're doing this. Now, I'm not a convicted felon. I've never been in trouble in my life, but everyone needs a right to vote. You can't find it in the Constitution of America where it says you commit a crime when you're 20 and now you can't vote when you're 60. It's not in there. They're just making it up as they go to stay in power, and it's ridiculous.
All right, that's Randy in St. Petersburg. Randy, thanks for your thoughts. Ian Sancho, certainly critics of the Florida legislature have agreed with Randy in terms of the law they passed, making it more difficult for people who fall into this Amendment 4 bucket to vote.
That was clearly the decision that the legislature, which, by the way, has been controlled by the Republican Party since 1998. I just want to point that out. When we say the legislature, the Democrats make no decisions on policies for the Florida legislature. It's totally controlled by the Republican Party. I want to make that clear, because when I talk about the legislature doing something, it's basically a one-party state that we have at the Florida legislature. And as a supervisor of elections from 1989, I've witnessed the Florida legislature make it more difficult for citizens to cast legal votes in this state, limiting things such as early voting locations, early voting times, kinds of identifications needed. There's been a consistent pattern by the legislature to make it more difficult for legal citizens to vote in this state, including laws which passed this past legislature, in which, for example, because a federal judge found Florida's cure process for mail ballots unconstitutional, the Florida legislature made the decision to allow citizens 2 days after the election to cure their ballots, which is ridiculous. They moved it from the day before the election to 2 days after. I would let the listeners know that Oregon, the state that developed mail balloting, provides up to 2 weeks after the election for its citizens to cure minor problems with their mail ballots so they would count. And Florida's efforts, quite frankly, are shameful in attempting to prevent legal citizens from voting and having their vote cast in this state.
Let me ask you as a quick follow-up, Ian, and certainly many callers out there and listeners agree. At the same time, we referenced that new polling data out this week from UNF, and it shows a majority of Florida voters approve of these changes to Amendment 4. They approve of asking those with a prior felony conviction to pay all fines and fees before voting. What's your reaction to that poll?
I don't base my decisions based on what's right and wrong on popularity. Fortunately, I'm not a legislator. I don't have to do what other people think I should do. I try to make decisions based on what is correct and proper for the citizens of Leon County when I served. And do the citizens even know the impacts of these changes? Because one of the things that our Constitution in Florida says, Article 1, Section 1, says all political power is inherent in the people. The people have more power than the legislature. The legislature doesn't really want to acknowledge that. And I submit Article 1, Section 1 of the Florida Constitution says that the political power in this state belongs to the citizens, not the Florida legislature.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Let's go to Steve in Dade City, Florida. Hey, Steve, thanks for your call. What are your thoughts?
Yes, ma'am. Well, I am a convicted felon from 1980, January, for a theft crime. I just got my civil rights back when this passed. And I am now 59 years old. I own 160 acres down there in Dade City, Webster area. I pay $5,100 a year in property taxes. And the reason I really wanted them is so I could sit on some of the volunteer boards, like planning and zoning, mm-hmm. environmental wetlands boards. I have 3 college degrees since and just got my civil rights back. 3 children, 16 grandchildren. Should I continue to pay those taxes and not be represented?
Do you know whether you can go and vote, or are you going to have to pay any back fines and fees?
No. I was released from prison in October 1989, and I've been clean since.
So as far as you know, you can cast the ballot, right, Steve?
Yes, ma'am, and I will be.
Okay. Well, Steve, I so appreciate your call and your thoughts. Steve Contorno, we're talking about a little over 1 million Florida residents that are potentially affected by this, right?
Yeah, and it's in Tampa, we especially have sort of an interesting case because immediately after the constitutional amendment passed, we had an election here where we had a large surge in voter participation among the people who had previously been disenfranchised, and they voted in a large block, and we got to sort of see what the effects of Amendment 4 would be. After the election, it was our local mayor's race. Then the legislature decided to take action and put in the implementation law, and so a bunch of people who were able to vote in our mayor's race may not be able to vote in the upcoming presidential election because of how things have changed since.
Wow. Now, getting back to the website that's not working, as folks try to enter petition signatures, we saw how hard the Amendment 4 activists worked to get that matter before the voters, and they overwhelmingly approved it. Let's look ahead to 2020. With all of these technical problems, do the activists behind raising the minimum wage or legalizing recreational marijuana, will they even be able, do you think, to get that before the voters by next year? It's some time to go, but what about that?
A lot of those initiatives are pretty well funded. The minimum wage one is coming from John Morgan, who has put a lot of his own money into that. The banning assault weapons initiative has also had a lot of grassroots support. So I think that a lot of the ones that are getting the most attention have enough muscle behind them to get the signatures and get on the ballot. The biggest question and the biggest impediment might not be the logistical hurdles, but whether Attorney General Ashley Moody is successful in knocking some of these off the ballot. She has been critical of the assault weapon ban that's been proposed, saying it's too vague, and has asked the Supreme Court to shoot it down. And she's taken similar postures on another of other amendments. So there's just sort of hurdle after hurdle to getting to February 1st and getting these on the ballot. And it remains to be seen who will be successful to get there in 2020.
It's a battle, and big money is involved, Ian. As Steve mentioned, John Morgan, the Orlando lawyer, pushing to raise Florida's minimum wage to $15 an hour. He's saying he's just going to spend more money on it. He has those resources. One individual in Orlando who played a huge role in the medical marijuana push, now doing the same with the minimum wage push. In the minute we have to the break, Ian, your thoughts on how big money is driving these petition drives?
Well, there's not been a purely citizens driven amendment to get a petition on the ballot since the ban the Nets operation, which was probably 20 some years ago. You have to have money now in order to do this process. The Florida legislature knows that, which is why they're putting roadblocks to basically force that up. And I would like to point out that it used to be that the petitions were due in August for counting to determine whether you made ballot position in November. And the Florida legislature a few years ago moved that up to February.
Yet another hurdle then, right? Yeah.
In other words, make it more difficult.
And we're going to continue taking your calls about this. Get on the line now here on the Florida Roundup. It's 305-995-1800. We're going to talk about some more election security questions after the break as well. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening this Friday. Tom Hudson is out this week. And as we continue talking about election security issues and ballot glitches here on the show, petition gathering glitches, we want your calls at 305-995-1800. Got some tweets here. Here are just a couple about Amendment 4. They tweet the show. One listener, Dell, says, I've said that tripping up ex-offenders for fines and fees is essentially a poll tax. Lots of feedback on that issue. Lots of calls as well. Nancy from Tampa is on the line. Hey, Nancy. How you doing?
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I'm
sure.
Doing well.
Sure.
I feel very strongly about this issue. I am a licensed clinical social worker and addiction specialist. I've worked in the jail and worked for the University of South Florida my entire career, and spent 8.5 years in the jail as an in-jail drug treatment program director. And many of my inmates did their time. I mean, they were sentenced, they did their time, they went to the in-jail drug treatment programs, they got out, they couldn't find a job anywhere because nobody wants to hire a felon. They couldn't vote, they couldn't live in public housing, they had no money because no one would hire them, so then the right to vote was taken away. And they used to have to go to the clemency board, petition the clemency board, it took about a year. They would come and interview all of your neighbors, interview your family members, interview everyone, come to your job site. You know, so there was nothing that you could cover, you know, and just be a normal human being just to be able to vote. Well, my advocacy part of me says if they can't vote because they haven't paid their fine, even though they've done their time, why does an upper echelon in the money structure, a couple who divorces and the husband or the wife does not pay their child support enforcement, why aren't they removed from the voters' polls? Why is the individual who doesn't pay the overdraft fees in their bank account consistently not taken away from them?
Nancy, I appreciate your insights on this, and I want to put it, thank you for that. That's Nancy in Tampa. I want to put this to Steve Contorno with the Tampa Bay Times. You know, Nancy's view reflects the majority of Florida voters. They approved Amendment 4. They saw the wisdom of giving former felons a chance to vote again. With everything you've been reporting on about all the changes to petition gathering rules for amendments like these, and now the problems with the website, is it fair to say that Amendment 4 would face too high a bar now to even get on the ballot if it were put before the voters in 2020?
That's a tough one. I'm not entirely sure what would have happened. I do think the legislature clearly reacted to so many successful ballot measures in 2016 by making it much, much more difficult. I mean, in addition to Amendment 4, there was the Greyhound racing ban. There was the vaping ban. There was a whole bunch of things that, you know, a lot of people say shouldn't be in the Constitution of the state of Florida, but there is no other measure or opportunity for a direct democracy to action to get something passed through through a petition process unless you go through the Constitution. So, you know, the more and more restrictions are put in place, the more difficult it will be. I don't know if Amendment 4 would have passed or not. There was a lot of support for it. It did have even bipartisan support to get across the finish line. But yeah, all these sort of hiccups and new rules and barriers would have put it a little bit more in doubt.
Let's shift gears just a bit now and talk about ongoing election security questions when it comes to our vote in Florida next year. Ian Sancho, you've been quite vocal about this and know quite a bit about it, I might add. Apparently, there was language in a bill in the legislature that would have provided audits to confirm electronic vote totals with paper totals. That would have made the vote hack-proof, correct?
Yes, and I think this is a critical issue that is flying under the radar because it's kind of like in the weeds and only those who have expertise actually follow this issue. But around the country, we have noticed that the threat of international attacks and penetrations of voting systems is here. We know that all 50 states were attacked, according to the Senate Intel report that was released last month. We were told in Florida that two counties were penetrated, but in the Senate intelligence report, they upped that to four counties because of a federal law that says that all individuals that are hacked are the victims and their identities cannot be released. Federal authorities will not tell state officials or election officials who the counties were. And quite frankly, this is not sustainable. And impacts on Florida's software that could alter the elections are, quite frankly, a huge vulnerability. And while the state and election officials are putting huge resources to try to block the attack from the front end, the issue that is critical is if you audit the paper ballots to confirm that the electronic totals on the machines match the paper, there can be no successful hack. We do not audit the paper ballots. In fact, our audits in the state of Florida are worth than useless, because our statewide audit occurs after, let me repeat that, after the totals of our elections are certified, and they may not be changed to reflect the accurate votes of legal citizens who may have cast their votes. And that's dumb, quite frankly. Technology exists today to allow every paper ballot in this state to be properly audited to determine the 100% accuracy. And that legislation was removed from Senate Bill 7066, which was the election package which passed this legislative
session. And what was the reason for removing it?
It didn't have a Republican sponsor for that particular amendment.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup. Let me just jump in from Florida Public Radio. Let me quickly ask you as well about something you were tracking. Some Florida counties were using a technology last year called Clear Ballots. You say in Hillsborough County, this technology resulted in a discrepancy of more than 800 votes?
Well, no, actually, because there was a discrepancy in Hillsborough County in the last general election between the official totals and the rescan totals of over 800, the supervisor of elections there wisely decided to purchase technology to properly identify the accurate vote totals, which is the clear ballot software technology. I know that the Secretary of State, Laura Lee, has seen this technology in operation. She spent more than several hours at the Leon County Supervisor of Elections office where this technology is employed. There are half a dozen counties in the state that have this technology that can confirm that the electronic totals and the paper totals are correct. But we are not allowed to use that technology because in a recount, only the state recount laws may be followed. Not using the best technology to audit our elections leaves our citizens open to hacking because the rescan process that we use in the Florida recount does not confirm that if the software has been penetrated, that it would be caught in the rescan or recount process.
In the recount process.
It would not be caught.
All right.
Right.
Steve Contorno, quickly, in the time we have left, listening to all of this certainly puts pressure on Florida Secretary of State Laurel Lee to assure the public that their ballot will be accurately counted, particularly if we see, as we probably will see, a very close election in Florida next year.
Yeah, between that and the high turnout we're expecting and, you know, the problems people are going to have voting in college campuses due to the changes in the legislature this year and you know, the problems we saw in South Florida with their ballot counting systems. I mean, there's just so much that can throw things into chaos. And like you said, it's going to be a very close election. Mm-hmm. So everyone sort of has to be ready for prime time. And we're only a year out from an election that we clearly weren't.
Yeah. You know, it's really troubling to hear that the potential to hack these systems still exists, Ian. And, you know, we're going to have to get more into this on another show. But I want to thank both of you for weighing in on these critical issues to Florida voters, both in terms of the impeachment inquiry, which we looked at earlier in the show, and then everyone who's weighed in on our ballot issues and election security issues in Florida. Here we go again, potentially. Let's hope not. But always fascinating to get your insights, guys. We really appreciate it. I encourage everyone to read Steve Contorno's reporting in the Tampa Bay Times on all of these issues. And Ian Sancho, you know so much about Florida's elections as a former supervisor of elections in the Tallahassee area, Leon County. It's always so great to get your insights as well. And hopefully you can keep us posted as we move through the next year, because certainly these issues are going to keep cropping up and getting the state's attention. So Steve, Ian, have a wonderful weekend, guys, and thank you so much for joining the Florida Roundup this Friday. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you.
Thank you both. And thanks to everyone who has called and tweeted and emailed the Florida Roundup. Follow us on Twitter at Florida Roundup. We love getting your tweets. And as we progress with this show each week at noon across the state in South Florida, Orlando, Tampa, Gainesville, Tallahassee, Jacksonville, the Panhandle, it's so great to hear from everyone. Keep that feedback coming because it really is very much appreciated. And that is our show this week. Thanks so much for listening. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are producers. Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, Technical Director. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations is Peter Mertz, with engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Corum. Theme music by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next Friday at noon.